it's time for us to get started this evening. I'm just going to tell you right now, that suits me okay, because this came up kind of suddenly for me, and work conspired against me last night to keep me from studying. I had got on call, and it's been quite a challenge getting ready in the short time. I thought it would have been very appropriate for Wayne Holt to have taught this class, because we're going to be in John chapter 6 tonight, and of course, Wayne's got some extremely good material on that, and has taught it. In fact, I mentioned that, I think, a class or two back when I was teaching. Nevertheless, tonight we come to the beginning of the period in the life of Christ known as the periods of retirement. I want to say this before we get into that. This quarter is coming to a close very quickly. So you, those of you who are teaching, who of you are going to be teaching, by the way? It's coming quickly, so get your preparations, rush your preparations to conclusion, for at least getting started with your classes. But the real thing I want to say is thank you for teaching. It's a wonderful thing for you to do, to help the congregation, to help our young children. And when you teach this material, just think, you know, first of all, the children that you're going to be teaching, with the exception of the very youngest of those, this is going to be the second, maybe third time they've gone through this, but they are 3 years older than the last time they started this material. So their minds are vastly more advanced. Regardless of where they are, their minds are vastly more advanced. So this is going to be an opportunity to study this material as a section together with them with the capability to understand more than they have ever understood before. And don't let this material, though we've studied it many, many times, don't let it become stale to you. Be impressed. Allow yourself to be impressed with the things that Jesus is doing as you teach these young children. They will sense your sense of awe at what's happening. And it only takes, it doesn't take any, you know, that's not fake. If we're not impressed with what Jesus did while he walked this earth, the attitude that he displayed, the holiness with which he walked, then something's wrong with us. We need to think a little bit more deeply about that. So allow yourself to be impressed with his humility, with his compassion, with his love, with his righteousness and his righteous indignation when the time came. When he needed to be stern, he was. When he needed to adjust to the crowd, he did. When he needed to speak blatantly and openly, he did. When he needed to speak in parables, he did. When he needed to do miracles, he did the right miracles. He did them in the right way and for the right reasons. And they were amazing, the things that he accomplished. And think about this. We don't have to wonder how God would be if he were on the earth walking as a man among us, because we know. We don't have to wonder, does God care enough to do such a thing? He not only did that, not only did he leave heaven to become one of us, to be with us and to walk as a man and still be God, but he did that to the point of sacrificing himself on the cross. It's an honor, it's a privilege for us to have this opportunity to teach this to these minds that are fresh and open and impressionable. So please, please take advantage of it. Let excitement and awe be your watchwords as you approach the classes. Teach them from your heart. I know that's hard to do sometimes when you're thinking about the volume of the material or just getting it right, which is very important. But don't let it be lost on you. That would be my big exhortation. And again, thank you very much for being willing to teach. Does anybody need a syllabus? We have some still up here. The standard syllabus, of course. I think Brent handed out some syllabi earlier as well. Does anybody need one? If you do, they're up here. Generally speaking, I've got six or so quarters worth of syllabi information up there. One thing I wanted to talk about, you know, kind of on the idea that these young minds are the next level up, an illustration that I have used with the 6th through 8th grade boys, now I'm not sure this would play well in other classes, but they seem to understand this point. Now, of course, you wouldn't want to use it every time, but it does illustrate to my mind the challenge that we're putting before them too. You know, it's not just us as teachers who are being challenged to break this material down and to convey it to their young minds, but it's for them too to not be satisfied with what they know, not to be satisfied with where they have been. And the illustration that I use is, you know, I ask the boys, you go out and buy a video game. You love that video game. Well, you play that first level. Did you say they don't love video games? The ones I know, they love them. So maybe not every boy does, but there are other illustrations in sports, for example. But they get that video game, and they want to beat that first level. And so they work through, they learn the controls, they do whatever it takes, and they beat that first level. Well, the thing I ask them is, how many of you are satisfied, or are you having beaten the first level? Do you just want to go back and beat it again, or do you want to go to the next level? Do you want to try the more challenging level now that you've mastered those skills? Well, inevitably, most at least would say, I got this game so I could go up through the different levels. I might play the whole thing, go through all the levels, and then come back and play it in superhuman mode. You know, I'll go up and make it harder. Because that's how we grow as human beings. And they need to be challenged to understand that they're not as little as they were, to try to grasp some of these things. And they can do it. Their minds are sharp and they're a good bit less cluttered than ours. All right. The periods of retirement is where we are in the scheme of things. So we're in the last of the seven sections of the life of Christ that we're going to be studying in this quarter, the last one that you're going to be responsible for. There are actually four periods, sub-periods of retirement that are covered in this particular section. Now, the periods of retirement begins just prior to the Passover. That's found in John chapter 6, verse 4. And that Passover is 1 year from the Passover that Christ will go to Jerusalem and he will die. So we're just 1 year away from the death of Christ as we study this material. This period lasts about 6 months. It begins, as I just said, just prior to the Passover, before the last one. And it extends to the Feast of Tabernacles, roughly, at the end. So that would be in the fall of the year. Now, some things that are contrast, and obviously the name itself conveys this, contrasted with the Great Galilean Ministry. How would you describe the Great Galilean Ministry? Just some of the characteristics of it as impressed upon you as we studied it.
Miracles.
Lots of them. Very important. What about the teaching? What was the nature of the teaching? Well, for one thing, it was quite public, was it not? Well, that's one of the key contrasts with this next section. Obviously, Jesus is going to be teaching. In fact, in this next period, he's going to be teaching deeper than in the first. I say deeper. He's going to build on some of the foundation that he has laid. His discussions will become markedly more spiritual in nature. And like any good teacher, he understands God himself in the Bible understands this principle that people understand best that which they've had a foundation laid for. You know, you lay the concrete foundation and then you build on that. You can't deal with the more complex subjects. The Old Testament in many ways prepares us for the spiritual lessons of the New Testament. Not that it's devoid of spiritual lessons, but certainly those are elaborated and extended tremendously in the New Testament. The same thing's true with Jesus' teaching. We'll see that, I think, in John chapter 6, that marks a division between more of the well, very practical teaching. To some, that requires some stretching of the mind and is more spiritually spiritual in nature, deeper. All right. So we said miracles, absolutely. We said public teaching. What about the location? All right, so mostly up in that area in Galilee. What about the level of resistance that he got? There was resistance, wasn't there? Some of it pretty sharp resistance. That's going to increase. It's going to come from different quarters now. Also, what about the responses of the people, the crowds by and large, have been pretty positive. Tonight, really, with the feeding of the 5,000, in many ways, what we see is the pinnacle of the popularity of Jesus with the crowds coming to him. Chapter 6 is going to mark this point where, many begin to leave Jesus. And it's that point when his teaching becomes markedly, to the masses, markedly more spiritual, more pressing. He's pressing them to get beyond just those miracles. All right. Any thoughts or questions as we go through this this class or right now? All right. The first story that we come to here in John chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, it's covered in all the Gospels. And one thing I'd like to say is that as you study this, if you try to synchronize them, it's a little bit difficult to get everything lined up, but it works out very nicely. You just have to interleave some of the comments. If you have a fourfold Gospel, it does a great job with it. If you read through it, you'll get generally a good sense of the flow of things, and that's true anywhere in the life of Christ. Not tremendous attention is emphasis is placed on the exact chronology in any of the given Gospels, and so when the things are given, some will fill in some details that others will not. You need to be able to coalesce those together as you present them. All right, so Mark records the beginning here. The apostles gathered to Jesus. Now, this is when they came back from having gone out on the commission, limited commission. The apostles gathered to Jesus, and they told him all the things that they had both done and taught. One of the things that they had been doing was miracles themselves. And he said to them, "Come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest for a while." Now, a very strong indication of the popularity of Jesus at this time is given right here. There's so many people thronging them. There's so many people making demands of them, both for the miracles, perhaps even for the teaching, that they didn't even have time to eat. When we think about Jesus going about at this period of time, it is marked by throngs of people. And they are laying the diseased, the sick, those palsied, those who are mute, blind, lame. They are putting them near him, asking him to touch them. And whoever does, by the way, is being healed. John says that, let me finish up there. They departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves. According to Luke, this was on the Bethsaida, Luke chapter 9, verse 10, on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. This is one of the chronological things that's a little bit hard. It looks like they double around to Bethsaida twice in this period of time. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great multitude followed him because they saw the signs which he performed on those who were diseased. And Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. So what we see is Jesus is, and that's why we call it periods of retirement, this is going to be marked by private teaching. And he's trying to teach his apostles, his disciples, things that the multitudes, they weren't ready to hear. They couldn't receive them. And may not have even been that interested in receiving. So he's pulling them aside. Let's go aside to a deserted place, rest for a while, and let me teach you, is basically what he's saying. But he couldn't. The people saw what was going on, and they followed him wherever he went. Now, he, I'm sure, had a period of time there where he was able to do what he intended, but perhaps not as long as he had hoped. The multitude saw them departing, and they knew him. Obviously, they recognized him, and they ran there, that is, to the place where he had gone to be aside with the disciples, the apostles. They ran there on foot from all the cities. Look at the excitement that the people had, the desire that they had to be with him, near him, to see the miracles, to, now, the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000, those things hadn't happened yet. That's going to bring that to a fever pitch, that particular motivation. But here, they want to be near him. They want to have the sick healed. They want to hear the teaching. They got there before he did, and came to him where he had gone. And Jesus, notice this, when he came out, he saw the great multitude, and he was moved with compassion for them. Jesus was not indifferent. It wasn't that he was so focused on his mission that when he saw people, he didn't dismiss them as ignorant. He knew that, and he will say so tonight. We'll study that he will point out their lack of spiritual maturity. He knows that they're curious. Maybe they are just looking to be entertained. He knows that their level of spiritual desire is not that great. But yet, he was moved with compassion for them. And what did he do? He taught them. He began to teach them many things. Luke 9 verse 11 says he taught them many things concerning the kingdom of God. In fact, let's look over at Luke and just read that little section there, because it does provide a few details. Eric, would you read Luke 11? Luke 9 verses 10 and 11.
And the apostles, when they had returned, told him all that they had done. And he took them aside privately into a deserted place belonging to a city called Bethsaida. But when the multitudes knew it, they followed him. And he received them and spoke to them about the kingdom of God, and healed those who had need of healing.
Okay, so this gives us some more information about those who had come. There were those among them who had need of healing. It also tells us more about what he was teaching. He was teaching them about the kingdom of God. He had done that. And would Matthew chapter 13, he's going to do a lot of teaching about the characteristics of the kingdom of God. But he's teaching them those sorts of things. He lifted up his eyes, John says, in John chapter 6, verse 5, he lifted up his eyes and seeing a great multitude coming toward him. Now, he's taught them. They've been with him. And he teaches, or he says to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" Now, he's asking Philip this. We understand now, in retrospect, of course, that he didn't need to go buy any food. But he's testing Philip. What we're going to see here in this and several of these next miracles, I think, he's challenging his disciples to walk by faith. He's going to challenge the multitudes to do that. That's John chapter 6. Don't walk by sight, but walk by faith. But the disciples, the apostles in particular, they need to graduate to that level. They need to see things. They need to act on that faith that they had. Had they confessed so far that Jesus was the Christ? They had, hadn't they? Did they believe that? Absolutely. They had fallen down and worshipped him. They had confessed the truth of the matter. They had seen his power over nature, over men, over demons, sickness, and they knew it. But yet, when he asked this question, "Where are we going to go buy some bread for these people?" He's testing Philip. He's trying to get Philip. He's not literally saying, is there a town nearby or do we have enough money? He's trying to get Philip to think, what are the possibilities? I mean, the way we would say it today is he was trying to get him to think out of the box. But he's trying to get him to think by faith. They had been with him. Was there anything this man, this Son of God, could not do? No. And yet, they still weren't exercising that faith. So Jesus is prodding them to do that. Philip answered. He didn't see it. 200 denarii worth of food, it wouldn't be enough to give every one of them a bite. It's just not enough. There were 5,000 men there, approximately, besides women and children. So you're probably looking at 10,000 people at least. So the idea, I mean, if you can imagine in your mind what 10,000 people look like, we're talking about if we've got 250 times 4 times 40. My math good? I ain't doing math in public. All right, so times 400. All right, so times 4 is 1,000. So times to get to 10. So times 40 would get us to 10,000. So you're talking about everybody. And I didn't do that in advance, and so I shouldn't do math without doing it in advance. But anyway, so times 40. 40 times the number of people we would have in the sanctuary. I did not use that word. Strike that from the record. That was a lapse. In the auditorium. So 40 times that. I'm really disintegrating here. You got to help me. Just a tremendous number of people. So obviously Philip, if he's thinking physically, it's no way. Not only would it be hard to have enough money and to locate that much bread, but guess what? You're in a fairly deserted place. It would be hard to get it back to them. So it's just not practical. So Jesus isn't really asking that question. And I wonder, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, says, there's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. You think there's... I don't know, because nothing more said. But I just wonder, obviously, Philip wasn't, or Andrew wasn't trying to say, let's divide that up. I don't think that's what he was saying. But it seems that he wouldn't mention it if there wasn't a hint of something in his mind that maybe Jesus could do something. I mean, it would be a ridiculous thought to even bring it up. So I don't know if Andrew suspected. I don't know that. But perhaps there was a little bit of faith there. Perhaps there was at least a curiosity on his part as to what Jesus might do with that. But we don't have to wonder what happens next. Well, that's... Yeah, the 5 barley. Yeah, who gets it? That may have been the question. Very good point. All right. Well, Jesus then, not a lot of discussion. He says, make the people sit down. And one of the passages, I think it's Matthew, he says, make them sit down by 50s. There was a lot of grass there. There's plenty of place for them to sit down. So they sat them down, and it wouldn't be very hard when you had them divided up like that to get a pretty good estimate of how many people were there. So it wouldn't have been, obviously the Holy Spirit wouldn't have any trouble with that. Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given things, he distributed them to the disciples. We don't know exactly how he did this. Doesn't matter. He distributed them to the disciples and those sitting down, likewise of the fish, as much as they wanted. They got as much as they wanted. And so when they were filled, that's when they took the disciples. He told them to go gather up the fragments so that nothing is lost. Now, they would have taken, the fragments would have been very, very valuable. 12 baskets full of food would have been something they would... Now, Jesus could easily make food at any time. That's very clear here. But is he saying that we should waste that? No. So he's being a good steward. He's showing that example. But the thing is, There was so much food there, they all ate as much as they wanted. They were all filled, and yet they had this tremendous amount of food left over. Now, obviously, some people would have posited that what happened here is that the people actually had the food with them, okay, and that when they saw food coming out, everybody was okay with sitting down and eating. I don't know if you've ever heard that nonsense, but that's what non-believers would say of this. I don't even know why you would bother coming up with something like that, but clearly that's not what happened here, because if people were going to be stingy with their food, why would they let all this food be collected afterwards? That's one thought. The other point is, it wasn't just a small amount of food to sustain them for a small amount of time. This was so much that they ate all they wanted and were filled.
Craig?
Yes, sir?
Don't eat too much of this, but think about this today. People this out, they were filled. That was putting up a capital on foam now into the spiritual food.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to deal with that. And he's putting that go for others. Don't make sure it's parallel. I think about
it.
And he's going to be one.
Yep, that's exactly right, and it's clear that he's using this. He, what did we read before in the previous slide? He knew what he was going to do. He wasn't simply doing it for that immediate reason. He could have sent them away; they wouldn't have all perished or anything like that. But he was using this as an opportunity. And in fact, the disciples were very comfortable with the idea. Dismiss this crowd so they can go buy him something to eat. Let them take care of it. There was no compelling reason that they would have to provide food for them. Jesus knew what he was going to do, and he knew why he was going to do it. And that is, he knew how this was going to unfold. He knew that he was about to make a tremendous discourse on the subject of spiritual food. The faith that they needed to have that he is the Son of God. That's the thing that they needed to be craving, as he's encouraged us to do, to hunger and thirst after righteousness. That's the same thing that he was trying to get them to do, to hunger and to crave spiritual the teaching, the faith that they needed to have. And as you pointed out very well, to do that completely, to be he that hungers and thirsts after righteousness will be satisfied, that will be filled. All right.
It also reveals the heart, because there was the group that were solely impressed with the fact that they were provided food, and they sought that again.
Mm-hmm. They sure did.
And that's when he lets them in. Mm-hmm. This isn't about food,
mm-hmm.
of satisfying physical hunger.
Yep.
So that's kind of separating the groups.
When you
started to make the distinction between miracles are there not just for the utilitarian aspect of why they were done.
That's right.
They were for another reason.
That's right. When you think about what, I mean, now certainly we can't fully envision this, but what would it be like to be the creator of the world, as Jesus clearly was, to have been endued with all of that power, endowed with all of that power, and knowledge and wisdom to know what is in the heart and mind of man, the tremendous responsibility to be the sacrifice for them, to live that life perfectly in the flesh, and then to see the immaturity that they had. Jesus in his teaching was always trying to pull people up from the physical into the spiritual. And it's the same struggle we have today. We tend to see things, we tend to place more stock in what we see than what we spiritually know to be true.
These people were that were without excuses. When you imagine the blood that was among the ground as he first starts building the food, first time they go back, and there's more. You come back, and there's more. Come back, and there's more. So the people are sitting there talking.
That's a good point.
So what's going on with this? What is this man doing? What is he doing? Man, he feeds you. There's a food left over. You have to be sitting there thinking to yourself, what kind of man is this?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you start speaking to people, go into the right heart and sit there and hear.
What is he saying? That's right. That's a very good point. I think it's a good point to that you can bring out as you're teaching the young children, the children in general, that as these people ate, they weren't unaware of what was happening. They knew. And in fact, that's cemented by the fact when these men saw, verse 14, what they had, when they had seen the sign, now Jesus did. Truly, this is the prophet who is come into the world. They recognized that this was a very notable miracle, and they drew the proper conclusion. As you said, the next step in that is, what is he saying? What is he teaching? Now, their response, however, was, again, in keeping with their expectations for the Messiah. They wanted to make him a king, and he perceived that they were going to do that by force. And for that reason, he departed by himself to the mountain. Now, at this point in time, he sent the disciples into a boat to go to the other side. But he departed to a mountain alone. Doesn't say it here in John, but he went to pray. And then, of course, he's going to join the disciples out on the sea later. Yes, sir.
You can kind of see what they're thinking. Here's a man that can raise people from the dead. Here's a man that can feed people with nothing. What kind of army is making that power?
Mm-hmm.
And you can see how they would think that this would be a great issue to have this nation that will be fed all the time. Where people perish in the battle, you're right. So,
yeah.
Just super.
Right, and if they were thinking about Daniel 2:44, for example, if they were drawing that, I'm not saying they were, but if some of them among them were, they would think, well, surely he is going to grind the rest of the world to powder. There's no one could stand before such a king. Any other comments? Immediately, Jesus made his disciples to get into the boat and to go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent them away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Yeah, here it is in Matthew. Now, when evening came, he was there. He was alone there. And the disciples, they had gone out onto the sea. And the Sea of Galilee, you look at it as a body of water, and you think, well, it doesn't look that impressive on the map. But it's a big body of water. When you're on it, we've seen pictures. You recognize it's not as tiny as it looks like that little blue dot. And not only that, there are very high elevations around it, especially to the north, and the winds, especially if they come from the east, they tend to sweep across there and be very violent. And that's what those disciples had gotten. They were caught in. They're out there on that, and they're in a very tempestuous sea. They're tossed by the waves. The wind was against them, so even though they would have normally been able to have crossed reasonably easily, they're struggling. Well, Jesus comes to them in the fourth watch of the night. When they see him, perhaps by moonlight, we don't know, they think that it's a spirit, it's a ghost, and they cry out for fear. But Jesus immediately spoke to them, saying, so he's not a long, long way away, they can hear him well, be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid. Well, Peter seizes on this and says, Lord, if it's you, command me to come to you on the water. Now, I want to hear your thoughts on, I've got thoughts on this subject, but I don't know if they're right. What do you think is going through Peter's mind at that point? What motivates him to say that? I'm not sure exactly what motivated him, but I'd be curious. Okay. I guess sometimes I think maybe too analytically, and I think, well, who else would it be? He says he's Jesus, and he's walking on the water. Who else do you know would be capable of doing that? So, but that's just my thinking. So I'm curious to hear what you think. I don't know. Maybe he did doubt that it was Jesus. I wonder how many apparitions Peter had seen in his life. I'm guessing zero. I'm sure he's like us. I don't know. It's just the way I think. When I read something, it just makes me think, why did he say that? Well, we don't know for sure. Maybe he just simply wanted some confirmation. Whatever the reason, he asked the Lord to command him to do this. And Peter did. The Lord said to him, come, and Peter got out of the boat. At that point in time, I suspect Peter believed. In fact, I'm almost 110% convinced that he did at that point believe that this was Jesus, because he had the faith to do something in a few moments. He ain't going to have the faith to do anymore. He got out of the boat. He believed that this was Jesus. He believed that Jesus had the power to allow him to do it. And he did it. He got out there and he walked on that water. But he looked around, and you can imagine. You're out in the middle of a tempestuous sea, and it's scary enough in a boat, but no boat, and the waves are crashing, the wind's blowing, the spray. He got to looking at the waves and the wind, and he began to doubt. And of course, as soon as he did, he began to sink. What is the first thing he says? Lord, save me. So this is full of illustrations for us in life. So often we get to looking around at the winds and the wave, don't we? We look at the troubles that we have in life, the things that are against our faith, the things that are against us living a quiet and peaceable life before the Lord, and sometimes we lose heart. Well, our reaction should really be no different than Peter's. We should depend upon the Lord. We should ask Him to save us, to help us. And of course, Jesus didn't pick this moment to scold Peter. He simply reaches out His hand and saves him. He pulls him up out of the water, and they get into the boat together, and immediately they were where they were going.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Did you read the comments of Bob Brady in his book? He said it wasn't Peter's faith, it was a lack of faith on his part that caused him to sink.
That's right.
He wasn't walking on the water because Jesus believed that he could make him fall.
Right. It wasn't Jesus' faith that was weak here.
It was Peter. He believed it.
That's right.
But as he got out there, and as soon as he took his eye off Jesus,
Jesus' response when he says to you, "O you of little faith," doubt, is indicative that clearly Peter's faith is what's in question here. Peter, it would have been no problem at all for Peter to walk out there, walk to shore, could have done what the Lord was allowing him to do, but he didn't have the faith to continue.
Right.
So you can see, even in this, it's not simply a show of Jesus' power over nature, but what is he doing here? He's pulling these apostles, their faith out into works. He's trying to get them to walk, in this case on water, by faith. He's trying to get them to see that God's power is alive and real, not only in Jesus, but in them. They're struggling to come to that conclusion, aren't they? They're struggling to see it. In every case, however, we see their response. Verse 33, those who were in the boat, that would have been the apostles, they came and worshipped Him. This is yet another incidents where they recognize Him, they confess it, and they worship Him. Truly, You are the Son of God. They draw the right conclusion, but they're having a little bit of trouble seeing the potential, the possibilities. All right, any other comments? Yep, if he had had that faith. Yep, that's right. That's a good point. On the following day, when the people who were standing on the other side, now this is a little hard to read, but basically what it boils down to is people who had seen Jesus leave, they saw the apostles leave in the boat, they noted that Jesus was not with them. Immediately thereafter, at the next opportunity, they left in boats and went over, and they found Jesus there. Well, they were surprised to find that Jesus was there, and they asked, "How did you come here?" They knew that there were no other boats that would have been able to have brought him there. They had come by boat. That was by far the most direct, the quickest way to get there. So there was no way that Jesus could logically be there. So they asked the question, "When did you come here?" Jesus does not answer the question. Instead, and by the way, we are not behind. We didn't have to get beyond verse 21, so I'm real happy about that. But Jesus says, "You're seeking me." Now we're going to see him begin to draw the lesson. "You're seeking me not because you saw the signs," that is the healing of the miracles even, "but because you ate of the loaves and were filled." Okay? Now he's got the stage set to make to bring this incredibly powerful lesson. "Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you." Does this sound familiar? Woman at the well. "Because God the Father has set his seal on him." All right, clearly he's beginning to make a contrast between the physical and the spiritual. And we'll see that continue Sunday morning. Any other comments?
I didn't know if it was 1-8. Thank you, sir.
No, not a problem. How's it?
I didn't realize that was his book.
I think we're being recorded. How do I stop this crazy thing? I'm going to take it to somebody who knows what they're doing.
Push the little clicky thing. I think it's still recording. I knew that.